The troops received logistical and combat support from the Air Force and the Army Ground Forces Airborne Division at the coastal zones in Hormozgan province. A combination of homegrown and creative military tactics was practiced in the offense exercise based on the new structure of the ground forces.
The main purpose of the war game is to evaluate the mobility and offense power of the Rapid Reaction Forces and Corps and the mobile offense units of the Army Ground Forces. They also practice rapid and decisive response to threats on the hypothetical enemy's coasts.
We talked to Iran's Army Commander Major General Abdulrahim Mousavi, who attended the drills, asking him if the extensive war games are in reaction to U.S. deployment of forces to the region in recent weeks.
It seems that the Americans are somehow confused and are suffering from indecisiveness. This is the first time in the U.S. history that they are in a very inappropriate condition. Our drills are generally preemptive, but as they may make some insane moves, we stage these maneuvers to say we are ready against any calculation error by the adversaries.
We also talked to the war games commanders, who gave more details regarding the drills on the land and at the sea.
Our parachuters descended from planes and then got on armored personnel carriers to approach the mock enemy targets and destroy them. In another part of the exercise, some special forces and divers will descend from choppers on the sea surface to get to the beach and fight mock enemy forces.
The Iranian military forces have held several massive maneuvers over the past few weeks.
The importance of this year's drills conducted by the Army's forces relies on the native nature of the equipment used in the event. Almost all of the equipment used in the war games this year are homegrown. Human Abedi, Josk.
Amid the recent growing of coronavirus infections in Israeli jails and the medical negligence of Israeli-Palestinian prisoners' conditions, the Palestinian Legislative Council, along with the Ministry of Palestinian Prisoners, held a press conference to express concerns of the serious condition of the prisoners at Israeli jails. Palestinians demanded an urgent action from the international community to save their life.
Our prisoners are dying inside the Israeli jails as the Israeli regime is practicing a slow death policy against them. The Israeli regime doesn't provide the infected prisoners with the required medical care. The international community should step in to save our prisoners' lives.
According to Palestinian Prisoners Organization, over 250 prisoners are diagnosed with the coronavirus, and the number is expected to rise due to the intentional medical neglect at Israeli jails, as Israel has stalled delivery of the vaccine to the Palestinian prisoners. Palestinians also demanded an international supervision to vaccinate the Palestinian prisoners and make sure they are delivering the required health care.
Palestinian prisoners are facing a serious danger that threatens their lives. Israel is using this virus against our prisoners to put further pressure on them. The coronavirus has already reached a number of Israeli jails and infected almost 250 Palestinian prisoners.
Palestinian sources say over 5,000 Palestinians are currently detained in Israeli jails, mostly with no charge. Palestinian resistance has warned that they won't remain silent and hold Israel responsible for the consequences of neglecting the health condition of Palestinian prisoners.
The prisoners' issue is among our top priorities, and we will do our best to set our Palestinian inmates free. The resistance holds the Israeli regime responsible for all the consequences of this dangerous move.
Palestinian detainees have continuously resorted to open-ended hunger strikes in an attempt to express the outrage at the detention.
While some 5,000 Palestinian inmates are suffering in Israeli jails amid the coronavirus pandemic, Israel has deprived them from their right to health care. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Quds, the axis of Muslims' unity. This is the theme of the International Webinar of Parliaments Supporting Palestine. Organized by Iran's parliament, the event was attended by parliament speakers and deputy speakers from Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Yemen, Indonesia, and other Muslim countries, as well as representatives of Palestine's resistance movements, to express their solidarity with Palestinians in their resistance against Israel's occupation. Delegates condemned Sudan, the UAE, and Bahrain for their normalization of ties with Israel, calling it a betrayal to the Muslim community.
It's a bitter tragedy to see that Palestinians' houses are demolished on a daily basis. 2 million Palestinians in Gaza are living in a prison-like area, and 5 million members of the Palestinian diaspora are not given their legitimate right to return to their homeland. What's even more tragic is that some Muslim countries have given the seal of approval to Israel's crimes by establishing political and economic ties with the occupying regime.
We call on the parliaments of all Muslim and Arab countries to take serious measures against the Israeli occupation of Palestine, and especially the unwelcome deal of the century that seeks to change the identity of Palestinians and their land.
The Arab-Israeli normalization came as part of outgoing U.S. President Donald Trump's so-called deal of the century. The plan, which triggered a storm of condemnations from Palestinians, refers to Jerusalem as Israel's undivided capital and recognizes Israeli sovereignty over large parts of the West Bank. While the controversial deal was championed by Trump, observers say the incoming U.S. administration is not likely to change course on Palestine.
For me as a Palestinian and the previous experience of all American presidents, they are, and especially Biden, he's having a big heritage of literature to support the security of Israelis, and he did nothing when he was the vice president during Obama's time for the Palestinian, except that speech and rhetorics, and we have gained nothing.
Palestinian ambassador to Iran says resistance remains the only way ahead of his people against Israel's occupation, since he believes that the path of dialogue does not work with Israel.
We have to unite our forces to be strong front, and all the Arabs and Islamic world will stand behind us. No other way, because they have proved always that they are not loyal to negotiations or to any other settlement with them.
Although the Arab-Israeli normalization infuriated the Muslim world, commentators say it should not come as a surprise, and it's only a revelation of their long-existing covert ties. This is why they believe the move will not lead to a seismic shift in regional power equations.
Delegates at the webinar underlined that Palestine remains the top priority and the innermost issue of the Muslim world, adding that Israel and its Western supporters have spared no effort in derailing that priority. They called on Muslim countries to stay united, as they believe this is the main counterforce against Israel's expansionist agenda. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
...2021 has so far been miserable for millions of business people and their staff across the 27-country European Union. Lots of outlets are being forced to close their doors to prevent the spread of COVID-19, with only essential retailers allowed to remain open.
You see that we have stricter measures than even a few months ago all around Europe.
Finance ministers from the 19-nation Eurozone have just concluded their first meeting of 2021 and warned that social inequality in the EU has yet to peak. Government and personal debt is rising due to the pandemic. We are reminded that the bloc has pre-existing economic problems. For example, in Greece, youth unemployment was running at almost 50% even before COVID-19 came along.
Do not forget the situation in Italy, where proper tax system is not in place, and France is facing enormous problems of unemployment.
The EU's spending watchdog, the European Court of Auditors, has been examining the bloc's initial response to the pandemic. During an online interview, a spokesperson told us that better cooperation is required.
Indeed, the EU has to learn lessons going forward, both to react better to the COVID crisis, but indeed to pandemics in the future, because pandemics aren't going away. There will be another one in the future.
EU finance ministers say COVID-19 recovery funding needs to be released without delay and spent wisely by member states. Meanwhile, the bloc's crucial vaccination programme is being rolled out too slowly, many health experts argue. Because the bloc is still in the middle of a health emergency and the start of a new economic crisis, analysts say the EU's response will not be fully assessed by citizens until the pandemic passes. based on current information, perhaps their verdict will not be good. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
An international rights group says that Israel, as an occupying power, must provide coronavirus vaccines to Palestinians. According to a press release by Human Rights Watch on Sunday, the Israeli authorities should provide COVID-19 vaccines to Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Human Rights Watch Regional Director Omar Shakir said that while Israel has already vaccinated more than 20% of its citizens, including Jewish settlers in the occupied West Bank, it has not committed to vaccinate Palestinians living in the same occupied territory under its military rule. Israeli authorities had, as of January 14, 2021, provided doses of the vaccine to more than 2 million Israeli citizens. Close to 150,000 coronavirus infections and over 1,500 deaths have been reported in the occupied West Bank and the blockaded Gaza Strip so far.
Article 56 of the 4th Geneva Convention requires Israel as an occupying power to adopt and apply the prophylactic and preventive measures necessary to combat the spread of contagious diseases and epidemics. The provision of COVID-19 vaccine to Palestinians is the duty of the Israeli occupying forces. Israel bears full responsibility for the health and well-being of people under its occupation.
Palestinians have accused the Israeli regime of practicing medical apartheid against them and committing mass human rights violations. Experts say Tel Aviv must end its discriminatory policies and remove any barriers that may hinder Palestinians from accessing or enjoying health care.
The statement by Human Rights Watch echoes the position of many international human rights organizations as it exposes the ugly face of the Israeli occupation. It also exposes the grave human rights violation by the Israeli regime, especially violating the health rights of Palestinians. Israel, as an occupying power, must meet its obligations under international laws and norms.
Human rights groups are expressing alarm over Israel's decision not to vaccinate more than 4.5 million Palestinians living in the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip, depriving them of their right to health care.
Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Austria extends its third hard lockdown until the 7th of February, announcing a new requirement for everyone to use FFP2 or N95 masks in supermarkets and public transport, and extending the minimum distance rule from 1 to 2 meters. The announcement comes a day after thousands took to the streets of Vienna protesting the COVID restrictions. The right-wing FPÖ party, which supports the protests, expressed anger at the decision, warning that people would no longer understand the necessity for the measures and persist in civil disobedience. Officials maintain that they would do the right thing, notwithstanding how popular it will be.
The results of our consultations over the past few days make us anything but happy and also make us anything but popular.
Studies have now shown that the new virus variant first discovered in the UK has been in Austria earlier than was initially suspected, currently affecting around 10% of positive cases.
If the new variant replaces the current virus as the dominant strain, 5 times more cases of illness and death can be expected.
Austria's health minister says the country is currently in the most difficult phase of the pandemic and that the situation is very challenging, at least for the next 10 weeks till the end of March, when warmer weather and more vaccinations can help improve the situation. Around 600,000 people are expected to be vaccinated by then. The goal is to reach a 7-day incidence of 50 new infections per 100,000 people. That number is currently 130. But there's light at the end of the tunnel, Austria's Chancellor says. With the vaccination campaign underway, officials expect things to look more normal in April or at the latest in May. Homolesky, Vienna.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we are currently cruising over Iranian skies.
ایستگاه شهید بهشتی مسافرین گرامی خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
Good morning, Mom.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
On Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite, words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee, and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. Oh, the most merciful.
The Debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Massive military drills of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps have come to an end. This after the IRGC has put on quite a show from central Iran to the Indian Ocean. Mock enemy vessels were targeted with long-range ballistic missiles with precision accuracy, hitting targets up to 1,800 kilometers away. Tehran says the maneuvers sent a message to adversaries to avoid attacking Iran, and military officers reiterate that Iran's might is for defensive means only. Stay with us as we take a look at these maneuvers on this debate.
Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has held a two-day massive military exercise in central Iran. During the drills, codenamed the Great Prophet 15, IRGC destroyed Mach enemy vessels in the Indian Ocean with long-range ballistic missiles. The first stage of the maneuvers kicked off on Friday by firing surface-to-surface ballistic missiles and operating bomber drones. The missiles, equipped with detachable warheads, are guided from outer space and are able to penetrate the enemy's missile shield. On the second day of the drills, the IRGC missiles detected and destroyed the targets as they were sailing 1,800 kilometers away in a remote area in the ocean. The operations were launched in the presence of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Major General Mohammad Bagheri, who said Iran does not intend to attack any country. However, he said Iranian armed forces will respond with might and promptly in case of any hostile move against the Islamic Republic. The IRGC military exercises started shortly after the Iranian Navy finished its drills in the country's strategic southern waters. The maneuvers are aimed at boosting combat readiness of the Iranian armed forces. The military drills come amid America's stepped-up military threats against Iran in the final days of U.S. President Donald Trump in office. In 2018, the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal and imposed heavy sanctions on the Islamic Republic. Trump cited Iran's ballistic missile program, among other issues, as the reason. Tehran has time and again said its missile program is strictly for defensive purposes. Like any other country, the Islamic Republic is entitled to boost its defense capabilities.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the program, journalist and historian Brett Yonkers out of Helsinki, and author and journalist Eric Wahlberg out of Toronto. Thank you both for being with us. Well, let's start it off with Brett. Tell us the significance of these latest drills and the timing of them in your perspective.
Well, I think the timing, of course, is of supreme importance here. We're talking about a very dangerous, very volatile time, being the last week now even, of the Donald Trump presidency. We know that Donald Trump is not exactly the most, let's say, held back person, not necessarily the most rational person as well when it comes to international policy in particular. We have seen what he is capable of. We have seen both domestically and in foreign affairs what he can do when he sets his mind to something, and it's not pretty. You know, it's nothing to be proud of. So, of course, for the Islamic Republic of Iran in particular, this is a very dangerous and threatening time. So I think that this is the perfect timing indeed to show such an impressive military advancement. We're talking about, according to sources within the Iranian military, that these long-distance ballistic missiles, these missiles that were fired at naval targets, this is a reach that has now been expanded from 300 kilometers in the past to 1,800 kilometers now, which means the Islamic Republic of Iran could fend off a naval aggression over 1,800 kilometers away before they would ever come anywhere near actually reaching the Iranian coast. So this is a very important symbol and a very important signal to make right now, to show that not just the people of the armed forces of Iran are ready to defend their country, but we're also talking about a very modern, high-tech military that has a drone and missile program at the ready in order to defend itself in case of any aggression.
Well, Eric, with what was displayed during the maneuvers and what you've seen, I want to ask you your perspective about the message that it could send and also about the preparedness of Iranian forces.
Well, I agree with Brett. This is a very important step that Iran takes at a very serious, crucial moment when Trump is still threatening and where when Biden is coming to power with promises to de-escalate the tensions with Iran and to return to the JCOA peace, so the nuclear agreement. So I think that it's not an aggressive move. It's quite clearly it's a defensive move, and it's important for this point to be made before Biden is pushed by his Zionist backers to try and tell Iran to stop supporting Syria, to stop supporting the Houthis, to stop the Israeli-U.S. aggression in the Middle East. Iran's military might is dedicated to self-defense and to defending its allies in the region, and there's nothing subversive about this. It's all above board. It's all according to international law. And so I'm very comfortable to see these demonstrations, and it is encouraging to know that whereas Israel and U.S. are at the forefront of military production of offensive weapons, that Iran is not going to be held hostage to these clear enemies of peace in the Middle East.
Well, actually, Eric, I want to pick up on what you just said. You said you're very comfortable seeing this. Brecht, I want to look at that because, of course, we know how Iran is portrayed by many countries, especially Western countries, trying to show that it's basically a very aggressive country. What Eric just said, that he was comfortable because of showing it's the domestic and also defensive capability as opposed to offensive. I want to look at that aspect of it. Why is it that though Iran has not engaged in an offensive war in 200 years in modern history, it is continually labeled and condemned for being an aggressive nation?
Well, this is all, of course, part of the propaganda mill. Indeed, as Eric pointed out, the Zionist backers behind much of the Western governments, of the so-called leaders of the Western world, the Zionists and the imperialist war hawks in general, they have an extensive influence in trying to basically beef up these war drums and beef up this war propaganda. And one of their most commonly used phrases, of course, is projection. Is basically one of the most common tactics of projection, that with which I mean everything that the West does wrong is being projected on another country as if it comes from them. The Western powers will say that these other nations are the ones that are potentially imperialist, expansionist, aggressive, colonialist, or neocolonialist, and are a threat to the nations surrounding them. We have seen similar, very clear examples of this in 2018 when Donald Trump made his demands to Iran. These demands include that Iran has to pull back from Iraq, even though they are there with the permission of the Iraqi government. They have to withdraw from Yemen, even though Iran is not involved in Yemen at all. They have to disengage from Syria, even though the Syrian Arab Republic has specifically asked, of course, for Iranian support in their defense against these terrorist movements that are incidentally backed by the West. So they project these sins and these crimes of the West and try to portray it as if it's Iran that does it, as if it's, for example, also the same thing happens with China, the same thing happens with the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. Every time when a nation that is not marching to the beat of the Zionists, to the beat of the imperialists in the West, they are portrayed as these madmen that are running around trying to destroy the world. And indeed, when you look at the situation on the ground, you see that Iran is surrounded on all sides by American bases, American forces, American soldiers, vessels, ships, planes, and the entire cabal of the military industrial complex of the United States, and in many ways also the United Kingdom, France, and much of the European Union, and of course the regional allies and puppet states such as Saudi Arabia. And so these, in order to masquerade what is going on here, the democratic West, as they call themselves, are trying to portray this orientalist image of the basically a return to the old medieval and later Nazi propaganda of the hordes from the East, let's say, that are threatening the democratic West, the civilized West, so to say. This is a tale that has been going on for centuries, And in a modern capacity, we have seen this return time and again. We have seen this happen during the Korean War. We have seen this happen during the Vietnam War. We have seen this during the war against Iraq, the war against Syria, the war against Libya. And this is something that returns over and over again. So this is some this is a psychological warfare. And unfortunately, it has been very, very successful up until recently. Now, fortunately, nowadays we have, of course, the internet and in alternative independent media to combat this monopolization of press and monopolization of the written word that has been dominating the West for so long. But it still remains very, very difficult. And this is, of course, why the Iranian authorities call this the soft war. This is a war of its own, the war of words, the war of truth versus lies, that in many ways is equally important to the actual war of bombs and guns. And this is what is going on here right now, and the war that is being fought in the minds of people every single day.
Okay. Well, Eric, I mean, if we look at, Brecht just talked about the war of words. I want to go back to the actual physical war. 40 years ago, of course, when Iran was basically attacked by Saddam Hussein's led Iraq. And of course, Iran tried to get equipment and weapons from everywhere, but basically to no avail with the help of the U.S. and its allies. We fast forward now, 40 years later, more than 40 years later, and we see the type of technology being used, and a lot of this missile technology, homegrown. I want to look at that aspect and the significance of Iran being able to do this under such severe sanctions.
It's, to me, it's a miracle. I every day I think, wow, Iran is fighting that monster, and it's got enough intellectual capability to do that. And that it really is very impressive. I think that if we can get that message out to people will, it's not to make people afraid of Iran, it's to make people respect Iran and its attempt to forge an independent and socially just orientation in the international sphere. And I wanted to commend Brett on his psychoanalysis of the situation, that you looked at someone like Trump. He is really psychologically, he's a very seriously tormented individual. And this projection that you see this every day, that people, they're full of hate and they project that hate onto someone else and say, you are the problem. So I think this is on a world scale, we're having a lesson in the human tragedy and the human comedy.
Well, Eric, let me just jump in here, because you talked about as far as Trump and projection. But is this a Trump problem? I mean, if we look at the history of the Islamic Republic of Iran, almost 42 years old now since the revolution, we've seen from the beginning this type of animosity that Washington has had against Tehran, and whether we're talking about a Democrat like Carter or a Republican with Reagan, or we fast forward all the way to Trump, it really hasn't seemed to have changed between the Democrats and Republicans as far as that animosity towards Iran and actually basically changing the narrative, as Brett has said, what they have done and their aggression, actually trying to show that it has been Iran. Let me throw this to Brett. Go ahead, Brett.
Yeah, this is definitely a key point to make in terms of, you know, American politics. Yes, Donald Trump might be the mad dog of U.S. imperialism in a way, although I highly doubt that Donald Trump is the person who actually came up with things like, you know, assassinating Shahid Qasem Soleimani or the nuclear scientists in Iran who were murdered under his rule. He is more of a person who is... He is the dog let loose, let's say, of U.S. imperialism, whereas a person like Obama was a person who could show more restraint and could pretend to be more diplomatic. But in the end, their goals are the same. You know, we should not kid ourselves and believe that the United States under Obama was using the JCPOA for a lasting peace. No, for them, they were hoping that through the JCPOA, they could somehow tame Iran into having, you know, like a velvet counter-revolution, you know, like one of those color revolutions that they have been doing in Eastern Europe ever since the late 1980s, you know. They were probably hoping for something like that, whereas the war hawks of people like, you know, John Bolton, Mike Pompeo, and what have you, they are more of the, you know, the blood and fire kind of types who want to destroy the nation completely, everyone who is standing in their way, and basically see the destruction all over the place until the United States reigns supreme. But in the end, of course, their goals are similar. Indeed, we have seen aggressive behavior from Democrats like Carter and Bill Clinton and Obama, just as we have seen it from Reagan, Bush, and Trump. This is a cabal, again, to say that word, of a two-headed snake, let's say. These are two sides of the same coin in the United States. Both Democrats and Republicans eventually serve the same interests and have been serving the same interests ever since the country of the United States was founded. This is an issue that has been going on for decades and even centuries. So when you see, you know, Joe Biden take the lead and say, I want to return back to the JCPOA, I want to return back to the negotiation table, we have to be very, very suspicious of their intention, because Joe Biden has said, and that's very important, I believe, he said, we want to negotiate back with Iran, but only, and there it comes, of course, if Iran, quote-unquote, keeps strictly to the rules and regulations and the stipulations of the JCPOA. And the problem is that the Americans have shown time and again that their interpretation of what is written in the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action is not necessarily what a normal person, you know, a neutral observer, mm-hmm. would believe that it says. They might use this document in order to pressure and push Iran even further.
And what we've seen, Brad, you were talking about using the JCPOA, and we've seen actually Trump talk about this, and others have hinted at it. Again, looking now at the missile technology. And, Eric, I want to talk about that, because in these maneuvers that we just saw, one of it was actually Iran flexing its muscles with that missile technology. And there are those who say that even under a Biden administration, that perhaps they're going to try to go after that. Overall, I just want to look at the situation. And where do you think this is all going at this point in time between the United States and Iran?
Well, I don't really agree exactly with Brett, or perhaps with you, on the fact that there is a cabal and they're all the same in Washington. I think that was a brave move that Obama made. I don't know why he made it. I think he was trying to get to put Israel in its place, because the Stutz worm that was destroying the Iranian nuclear facilities for a while, that was a U.S.-sponsored secret program that was supposed to be under U.S. control, and Israel took it and ran and did what it wanted. So I think that there is a difference, and I think that Biden is a continuation of Obama. He must be aware of all of that background. He's no fool. And I think that I look at this as the same way as when there was detente with the Soviet Union in the 70s, when the U.S. was weak and it made an agreement with the Soviet Union, and it was very positive. It was very positive for the world. It relaxed the tension. And I really hope, and perhaps I'm being too optimistic, but I hope that Biden will fulfill his pledge to return to the program, allow Iran to get its economy back in shape, and to live peacefully in the region with the other people. Iran is not an enemy of Israel. If Israel would just stop being such an aggressive and horrible nation, everyone could make peace with it. So I think that Iran plays a vital role here to stand up to the power and speak the truth. And I really hope that will happen. I'm trying to be optimistic. We've got a few days before Biden comes to power. Let's hope that he does what he should.
Well, Brett, your take. Eric said basically, obviously you heard him, that he's very optimistic. But what it seems, that if we look again at the more than four decades of the existence of the Islamic Republic of Iran, is that Washington has a problem with Iran being independent. and even morally supporting other independent movements. Your take on the future between these two countries now?
Of course, it's very hard to predict, let's say, or to think about what will happen. But I always try, of course, to be, you know, somewhat optimistic myself in regards of what the future might bring. You don't want to look at it too negatively, of course. But I believe that there is a chance that the United States will eventually learn to, you know, leave Iran alone and let Iran, you know, develop its country the way they want to, and develop ties with whatever country they want to, within the axis of resistance, for example, and beyond, and that America will eventually learn how to cope with it, to deal with it. But I believe the only way in which this is possible is by Iran basically building up its capacities for self-defense and its say, its weight in world politics to such an extent that the United States will be forced to recognize the situation as it is. I believe one of the examples I could use for a nation that has in the past faced incredible hostility from the United States and is now considered by the United States as a normal, respectable partner in everyday politics is Vietnam. Of course, I sincerely hope that Iran does not have to go through the terrible tragedy that Iran had to go through for decades in order to get to that position. But it is a fact that the United States was eventually forced, starting in the, you know, mid and late 1970s, to declare that they were basically, that they had been defeated, that their goals, their plans had been foiled, had failed completely due to the resistance and resilience of the Vietnamese. And ever since then, give or take certain disagreements, the United States and Iran and Vietnam are treating each other more or less as equal partners, as just normal nations that conduct diplomacy and trade with one another. Okay. So eventually, if Iran really shows itself to be the strong regional power that they are and that they have every right to be, I believe only that will eventually force the United States to come to the conclusion that they cannot win this policy of maximum pressure anymore.
So resistance and strength is what you said. Thanks so much for being with us, Brett Yonkers, journalist and historian out of Halsat, and Eric Wahlberg, author and journalist out of Toronto. And thank you for being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Glad to have you with us. Goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The Epic of 8-Year Holy Defense.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, we have said several times that the Iraqi dictator Saddam's main goal of initiating the 8-Year War and invading Iran was to overthrow the Islamic Republic system. He pursued other goals too, but he and his masters in Washington, Moscow, Tel Aviv, and Europe didn't reach any of their goals. For sure, the 8-year imposed war, or the holy defense, was one of the, if not the most important and most fateful periods after the victory of the Islamic Revolution. It was also one of the most effective events in the region, as its consequences have remained in the region and the world after the lapse of over three decades of its end. That 8-year period left such deep impacts on Iran's military, cultural, economic, political, and social life. The 8-year war caused such a great deterrence power to Iran that today the world powers, especially the United States, are scared of any aggression and evil thought against the Islamic Republic of Iran. Stay tuned for the last episode of this series. The 8-year war, apart from its hardships, destruction, and bitter events, left behind unique epics and unforgettable honors for the Iranian nation and the Islamic world. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, a few months before departure from the mortal world, issued a message, part of which reads, "Every day in the war, we had a blessing, which we have benefited from in all sins. We exported our revolution to the world. We proved our innocence and oppression of the invaders in the war. We removed masks from the face of deception of the world devourers. We recognized our friends and foes in the war. We came to the conclusion in the war that we have to stand on our own feet. We crushed the awe of the two Eastern and Western superpowers. We consolidated the roots of our fruitful revolution in the war. We in the war caused the sense of brotherhood and compatriotism to flourish in each of our people. We in the war showed to the people of the world, especially the regional people, that one can fight all powers and superpowers for long years. Our war resulted in the victory of Afghanistan. Our war will result in the victory of Palestine." Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said on the support of the West and the East for Saddam during the 8-year war, "Throughout the Cold War era, there had been no issue in which the two world superpowers had such a unison so that both of them gave military equipment to one side. Since the Second World War till the era of the Holy Defense, you cannot find such special conditions. This was an exception that Saddam enjoyed both the unsparing economic, political, and even military support of the West to some extent, and besides, there were the vast military supports of the East. The whole army of Saddam was equipped with the weapons made by the Soviet Union and its East European satellite states, which were inside the Warsaw Pact and the Soviet superpower at that time. This was a strange thing. In this war, we were oppressed in the real sense of the word. Once, one of the officials was explaining that when we wanted to pass across the Soviet soil to import the barbed wire that we had bought from a country, but we were not allowed. It was one of the rare points of the contemporary era that a revolutionary country which had stood against the U.S. would face such restrictions by the Soviets." Dear listeners, the Eastern and Western blocs had come to the conclusion that any revolution with a religious nature would cause serious challenges, there being. Thus, they spared no effort to prevent it from thriving. Moreover, the fake Zionist regime of Israel and the backward Arab regimes in the region became very scared of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, which would put their illegitimate interests at stake. They were afraid of the revolution's turning into a role model for the regional nations, most of whom have not experienced the taste of popular rule and true democracy. Thus, both the West and the East threw their weight behind Saddam in all its all-out aggression against Iran. And that only 19 months after the victory of the Islamic Revolution. We'll be right back. The eight-year war was imposed on Iran while the Islamic Republic system was still an infant and had not become stable. Furthermore, there were separatist groups here and there in the country. The Islamic Revolution Guards Corps and Islamic Revolution Committee forces, also with popular volunteer forces, had the mission of maintaining security in the country, and the army had just started tasting the sweet days of independence, while many of its remaining equipment were unusable, as the foreign, mainly American military advisors, had left the country. However, 1 year into the war, Saddam's war machine was stopped through the unmatched unity of army, IRGC, and Basij force, and formation of resistance units. By the end of the seventh year of war, Iran turned from defensive into offensive side in the war, in spite of all-out supports of the West and East for Saddam. Saddam's supporters, especially the United States, seeing his successive failures in the war, intensified their support, and Washington directly entered the war in favor of Saddam in the waning month of the war. In such circumstances, Imam Khomeini, as the commander-in-chief of the armed forces, came to the conclusion that accepting the UN Security Council Resolution 598 was to the benefit of the Islamic Republic. The eight-year war was the only war in the history of Iran in which the entire soil of the country was liberated from occupation. Then, as the Imam had predicted, Saddam invaded Kuwait 2 years after the end of the eight-year war and seriously threatened the Arab regimes in the region. Therefore, these regimes expressed regret over their supports for Saddam during his war of aggression against Iran. The eight-year war caused the regional and transregional powers to recognize the Islamic Republic and understand that Iran had turned into a big regional power. So, they admitted Iran's power in the regional and even global equations. Thus, the Islamic Revolution went from strength to strength through the selfless steadfastness of its youth. Yet, the United States and its allies, or partners in crime, didn't stop their enmities against the Islamic Republic after the end of the war. Nevertheless, as the enemies have aggravated their hostilities, Iran has become more and more powerful and stable and has made bedazzling breakthroughs in various scientific and military spheres. In some of these areas, Iran ranks among the 10 countries in the world. To mention a few of them, Iran is among the 10 countries which enjoy the full cycle of nuclear fuel for peaceful purposes. It also has gained the capability of launching satellite to the orbit. The Islamic Republic stands among the few countries which have access to the know-how of nanotechnology and stem cells. Iran owes all this to the eight-year holy defense.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up,